VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this is the Game Podcast. Now, in the next 40 minutes or so, I'm going to try and make sense of an incredible final weekend in the Premier League. But of course, even I cannot do it alone. So I'm going to need help, and I've got help from Tony Cascarino, Alison Rudd, and we had to call out the big gun, Ollie Kay from Rippenden. Despite his chest infection, despite his 1950s telephone, he's with us too. So let's start at Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea... two places, the Stadium of Light and, of course, the City of Manchester Stadium. Unless you've been hiding under a rock, you know what happened. A City were losing 2-1, United were winning 1-0, and then in the space of 126 seconds, Edin Dzeko and Sergio Aguero scored deep, deep into injury time for Manchester City as they win their first league title since 1968. Ollie, only fitting that we begin with you. I want to throw this at you. I was struck in the post-game interviews, Roberto Mancini saying that with 5 minutes to go, he said, no, this is impossible. He was sure they'd lost. Whereas Vincent Kompany, or Vincent Kompany, as one moron keeps calling him, kept saying, no, we believe because we had scored those late goals against Spurs and Sunderland. Did you believe?
I believed it was possible to do. I believed it was possible to score two goals in the final minutes against a team that was had just learnt that it was safe. But the thing was that all around the ground, you looked at the fans and they were just looking at each other as if, you know, the game was up. You looked at the players and heads were dropping, shoulders were dropping. And Kompany, I would say, was one of the few exceptions. Kompany, Zabaleta, Aguero, De Jong as well. These were the players that really stood up yesterday. And I thought shoulders were dropping, hopes were dropping, but there was enough character in the team just about to get them through, and it was just an incredible experience to be there and an absolute privilege to be there.
Alison, only there being his usual anti-English self, because of course when he mentions which City players stood up, he only mentioned foreign ones. I don't know if you noticed. But I thought as this was when Ollie was talking about the City fans and what they went through, you sometimes think of a fan base and developing expectations, and so how United fans perhaps generally expect to win and are surprised when they don't. When you're a City fan, when you think of the last 44 years, when you think of even the last time you won a league title, it was totally overshadowed by the fact that then United went and became the first English side to lift the European Cup less than a month later. Do you think it kind of multiplied their sense of, oh, right, we've screwed this one up?
They probably didn't need it multiplied, I think. I suppose what you're asking is if the roles were reversed, would United fans have their believed, body language and their songs and the vibe from the terraces, would they have been completely different? actually, they might well have been. Actually, I mean, my uncle Wilf is a big City fan, and he was texting me, "Not, I'm so excited." He was texting me, "This is going to be horrible." And I suspect the vast majority of contact between City fans was of that ilk. It was of the, we're almost not looking forward to this. This is going to be dreadful. And you know, afterwards he didn't celebrate. He went and lay down in a dark room for 7 hours because it is part of the fabric of what you become. I think, I mean, it sounds a bit romantic and maybe a bit airy-fairy to think there's a style of being a fan and that it might have an impact on the pitch. But I think you could make a case for it in this instance, actually.
Cass, is this an extension of what we talk about when we talk about sort of winning mentality of a club or the culture of winning, as we like to call it in my country? But the fans, the players, does it bleed into it? Mm. Is it easier if you've been there and won things?
Well, first of all, Gab, I think just adding on to what Alison said, is thinking that Man City's been a club that's, you know, been watching their rivals across the road dominate English football. And with that, you know, I'm sure the pubs and the bars and the restaurants has been a weekly, daily thing of, you know, them having to eat humble pie and watch Man United be so successful in that period. And then they get an opportunity and it looked like they were going to fall flat on their face. I mean, I'm watching the game and I'm thinking, they don't know what to do. They're clueless. They keep going out wide. They keep hitting in. QPR players keep heading it out. And I kept thinking of, this is a bit like Chelsea-Barcelona, where Barcelona just couldn't break them down in the end. 10 men and they're getting frustrated and you can feel it from the terraces. So all that, I mean, strangely enough, I'm crying for Edin Dzeko to come on for something different. Not whether we
were. Are you having an affinity for the big centre forward?
Well, I just thought something different. Oh, yeah. Need something and change. You can't keep trying to play this and to play this way. And I'm thinking as the game goes on, where's the dribbler? Where's the guy, the winger that can beat somebody? Because there isn't any of these dribblers anymore. Everyone wants to get a touch, whip it into the box. So I'm thinking all these things as the game's going on. I couldn't see for love nor money City get back in.
But Tony, you are best placed, the only one here placed to know. Do you, as the player on the pitch,
yep.
is the overwhelming sense of what's going on in the dressing room
affect you? Oh, absolutely.
So if you'd been a City player yesterday and you tapped
panic.
Into
yeah.
that
yeah, yeah.
nervousness.
Alison, you feel the tension. When you're out there and, you know, I've been in the World Cups and major games in, you know, internationally and some club football games where you absolutely feel the pressure of what's happening around you. And strangely enough, it's no comparison at all, but I was with Nancy on the final day of the season and we had to have 5 results go against us to go get relegated if we won. And we knew that 4 of them were winning. We knew 4 of them had got their results. We was waiting on one more. And you could feel on the terrace and as a player, and then it happened. And then you're thinking, is the information right? You know, is it right? So you're trying to concentrate on what you're doing. But people, you absolutely get affected by... It's the same of, you know, do you get affected by booing? Of course you do. If you hear it and someone's giving you a stick, it does have an effect on you because look at the amount of players that suffer when they're getting stick from the terraces. And that's, you know, in many forms, players do feel what's happening on the pitch and they try to concentrate and just do their job, but it can be very, very difficult.
Ollie, you buy into this? You think that's why City were basically so bad for so much of the game?
I think if you look at the way the game went, they absolutely dominated possession. It was, as Tony said, very like the Chelsea
Barcelona
game.
It's not very difficult to dominate possession when the other team's got 10 people standing in the 6-yard box.
No, exactly, but it's very difficult to find a space to create really clear chances when the opposition is defending like that, as we saw yesterday, as we saw in Barcelona the other week. City had some, I read that there was some of, where Aguero's shot was something like the 44th with quite neat symmetry of the game, or 44th that City had, which, you know, you could talk about sort of five or six near misses, but they weren't really creating the kind of clear chances that you would have expected them to. I think a lot of that had to come down to QPR because I thought they defended heroically for a team that were battling against relegation. But I just felt that belief seemed to drained from the City team as the game went on. Idea, you know, the creativity seemed to diminish, and as Tony said, they needed something different. I always think that the options from the bench are surprisingly limited in terms of the variation or variety of players that they've got, but somehow they muddled through, and I have to repeat, it was astonishing, incredible.
We have to move on. You talked about penetration and things that are lacking. Obviously, there's something very wrong with Joey Barton. You know, he's said he's not the... There's a great James Ducker piece. He said he's not the Antichrist, but I don't see anything redeeming in him. And I think in some ways, I can deal with a bad guy better if he just shuts up and plays a bad guy all the time, but doesn't go and make the be the sensitive guy. Those who don't know, again, and you must have been living under a rock if you don't know, but... He tangled with Carlos Tevez. He felt that Tevez had lashed out at him. I didn't really see it on television. But, of course, his response was to elbow Tevez in the head away from the play. Then he and the referee called him over. Mike Dean sends him off. And then after he sends him off, as he's going off the pitch, he decides to go and knee Sergio Aguero in the back and then tries to headbutt Vincent Kompany and then pretends like he's going to attack Balotelli but then thinks better because he knows Balotelli's crazier than he is. That's a fair summation of what happened, Tony. Now, I'm not going to ask you, you know, we've all been there. We play football at a higher level. We've all seen people go crazy. You've played with some crazy people. But what's ugly here is this weirdness of it's not just somebody losing his cool. There's a whole level of premeditation. And he appears to indicate that because either Joey Barton or, I don't know if he's a servant, he pays to tweet on his behalf and look up those quotations on the internet, but actually tweeted that as he was going off the pitch, one of his teammates said, oh, take one of theirs with you, meaning, like, go attack Aguero and he might retaliate, and then you'll both be down to 10 men. Now, as I see it, Cass, there's two options here. Either Joey Barton is basically grassing up a teammate, because that's a very serious thing for a teammate. You would expect a senior teammate to tell him. And that's really bad, because he's getting his own club into even more trouble than he's got himself into. Or it's even worse because he's just lying and inventing this, as perhaps he might have lied and invented things in the past, to go and shift the blame to one of his teammates. Which is it?
I don't know. I don't know if Joey knows either, really. I find him a very frustrating guy. I think he's nasty. You talked about the incidents there, Gab. What got me at the end was even when he was being led off and he had Eddie Nowitzki, and he had Kevin Hitchcock alongside him. And I know them both because I was... Two goalkeepers. And Kevin Hitchcock is trying to just lead him away. And he turns around to say to him, and you can tell him, get off me. And I'm thinking, you're one nasty piece of work. Hitchy's a really good guy. I mean, I'm not saying because he's a good guy anyway, but he's trying to escort him away, get him away from the trouble, get him off, and he's obviously thought, get him down the tunnel, get him away from this pitch. And he's still prepared to have a go of a member of his own staff. And I thought, that just typifies you, because you're a nasty piece of work. He makes quotes all the time. I don't read them, Gab. I a lot of stuff I just ignore with him, because I find him frustrating. I saw him on TV a few months ago having a go at Carl Henry, and he was talking as if Carl Henry only could make his name but because he was kicking Joey Barton. Well, I'm sorry, Joey's not that big enough and not that good enough to be a person that someone else, you know, like Carl Henry needs to put himself on a platform and be lifted. He is an average player at the moment, and he's been average all season, and with that nasty side, I just thought, do you know what, Mark Hughes has got now stayed in the Premiership. Now, what was your first job? What might be my first job. My first job was to get him out of the club, because he's a problem. Because when you have players like him, when they're brilliant for you, they can be one of the first players on your team sheet. When they're not and they're a problem like he can be, they're the first person you want out the door. And that's one of my first jobs. Because I after yesterday and what you said, Gab, about the, you know, teammate, and he just seems to have no conscience about what other people, and like you said again, you know, the consequences of what he said. He seems to take no responsibility at all.
Ollie, you argued, I think it was last week, you wrote this big column arguing that Joey Barton is a role model for everybody and should be England captain at the Euros. I'm just kidding. Yeah, he didn't really do this. But to you, Do you buy what Cass is saying? I mean, do you see a possible redemption for this guy? Do you think he wants to redeem himself? Or should we even stop talking about him and, like, pretend like he doesn't exist and, you know, sort of shun him the way the Amish communities do with miscreants and scumbags?
That might do him some good in some ways. I've come across Joe Barton a number of times, dealt with him sort of on a one-to-one basis, on interviews. I've met him sort of for a chat once or twice, and I have always found him great company, charming company, bright, intelligent, interested in things that are things beyond the normal footballer conversation you would have, if I can put it that way. And I struggle to work out what it is that turns him into a sort of psychotic figure at times that he clearly has been. And there's clearly just something he's clearly not wired correctly in some certain way. And the elbow yesterday, it was irresponsible. It was irresponsible, like the John Terry thing was in Barcelona, but it was also, but I would say that what followed was far, far worse. I mean, the look on his face was one of pure aggression.
Allison, I'm assuming, unlike Ollie, you didn't go hang. You haven't spent much time hanging out with Joey Barton,
smashing up McDonald's
and things like that. But
no, but I do read his column in The Big Issue, and I like the fact that he does that. And I think he's a complex character, and I think he has decided he's a truth warrior in some way. That he wants to be as honest as he can, whilst being a difficult person and an aggressive person. He has a brain, and I think he sounds conflicted and confused. And I think it's interesting that you seem more cross that he lied in a tweet than got sent off in a crucial relegation battle game.
Because my expectations of this person are incredibly low. I think he's a bad person. I mean, I think at some point, you know, we have to stop this whole, like, moral relativism, you know, garbage. This is a guy who's received all the – he's not 18 years old, right? He's pushing 30. He has reproduced, okay? He's been allowed to do that. He's got one bad thing after another. He's received all the help in the world. That sporting chance guy. He makes £4 million a year. He could hire bodyguards. You know, in the NBA, there are some players who can't help but get themselves in trouble. So they hire bodyguards to walk around them and to stop them from getting in trouble. I think Tony, you and I both know of at least one footballer who does that as well.
This is
the reality of this individual, and we kowtow to him because he's some interesting.
No, we're not kowtowing. I think the opposite is happening. I think we're talking about him. There are many players who play like Joey Barton and commit stupid fouls and are over aggressive on the pitch, just like Joey Barton.
That's not the problem
with
Joey Barton.
But they don't. They don't try and intellectualise it afterwards, and they don't have platforms here, there, and everywhere.
Let me get this straight.
So you don't like the fact he tries to explain himself?
I don't like the fact that he, if as seems to be the consensus, I don't like the fact he comes up with implausible explanations, which appear to me like lies, and where he implicates his teammates. I don't like that. But a lot of these other very aggressive players aren't people who spent 77 days in prison, who broke Usman Dabo's jaw, who've got such a history of nastiness. That's what bothers me about this. At some point, you know, can we not make a difference between – do we have to treat everybody the same? Do we have to go and say, like – why can't we say this is just a bad person? And if he wants redemption, then he can go and redeem himself. If he doesn't care about redemption, that's fine. Keep doing it. But you know, why do we have to treat Joey Barton and Jason Roberts as if they're the same person, for example? Mm. Just to mention somebody who's good versus somebody who's clearly bad. Moving on from Joey Barton to slightly more topical issue, perhaps, because as I said, I'd like to make the rest of this season a Barton-free zone, what's left of it. But inevitably, Ollie, we attach so much importance to victories, and perhaps rightly so. In the end, Manchester United, lest we forget, have exactly the same number of points as Manchester City. And yet, inevitably, we're going to be talking about, oh, look, it's a shift of in the balance of power and all this jazz. Is it a shift in the balance of power, or is it simply a case of United actually probably overachieving this season, given some of the difficulties they've had, and finishing level with City, and it's actually hard to split them, and we're in for an exciting couple seasons?
I think United have done exceptionally well to get 89 points. I don't think this is a great United team by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think they've got the quality of individuals that City have got. I think City is stronger man-for-man in pretty much every department. So it says something about United that they've managed to keep pace all season and somehow get into a position where they were 8 points clear and then finally blow it, which still defies belief, really, because they're the last team that you would expect to do that. But in terms of what happens next, well, I can see City going from strength to strength, and I could see United not spending, because they generally don't spend huge amounts of money under the Glazers, and if they don't do that, then they are in serious danger of getting left behind, because although Fergie might think Jones, De Gea, Smalling, all these younger players, Hernandez, Welbeck, maybe he will think, well, they're equipped to dominate English football for years to come. You look at Silva and Aguero, these guys aren't exactly old, and I wouldn't swap Hart for De Gea or Aguero for Welbeck or whatever. I think City have got better players, and I think they're going to get even better players this summer.
Alisson, if I'm a United fan and I want to see the glass as half full, I've got plenty of reason to do so, though. I mean, in spite of what Ollie says, if I bring in a legit midfielder, somebody who can run and defend and provide a bit of leadership, then, you think De Gea, who finished the season, I thought, quite strongly, is going to be even better next year. You presume Jones and Smalling aren't going to get worse. Vidic is going to come back and dominate. Rooney had in the end, even though he tailed off a bit, scored a lot of goals this season. And if the gap is 0 points, don't I have just as much reason to think that I'm going to be better next season against a City side that's going to lose Tevez and where Balotelli might go insane again and might buy the wrong people? And
yeah, if you're a United fan,
as you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
That's what you'll be talking about this week. I think also added to that, you've got the fact you've got a manager who seems to pulls something out of his own psyche and managerial ability when he has a proper opponent. And now he knows that City are the real thing, and he knows they accomplish something that takes them to a new level. He'll love rising to that, and he seems to get cleverer when he has an opponent he can really focus on. He did it, the famous knock Liverpool off the perch thing. I mean, he'll have another sort of focus for his to give him energy, I think. So if you're a United fan, you'll feel, yeah, Fergie won't sort of become suddenly overnight looking like an old man. He'll be re-energised by the prospect of it. And the trouble is, I think Ollie's right. I think in actual fact, City will beat them for the players that they have. But I think probably what will happen is next season, this United team, as you say, Gab, with maybe one or two additions, will be better than they were this season. And Fergie will be sharper than he was this season. But thereafter, I think they might diminish simply because of the amount of income being spent on players.
Well, I can't imagine City not spending 100 plus million again this
summer. We're a financial fair play. Are we all forgetting that?
I always think clubs find loopholes. And I've said it to you before, Gab.
And I've said to you, they can't because UEFA are vigilant and they're aware of all the loopholes.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if money's not spent. I can't believe that clubs have always opened doors. And I think they'll spend big. Why would they do anything different to get to where they've got to? And they'll look for the biggest players in world football if they can. I think United have to make certain starters. I made a point in the paper this morning about Man United with a team under Fergie. When they broke the power, they went after British transfer records, they got players that were certain starters in their lineup. And the moment they stopped doing that, which is really the last year, because if you look at their sort of Trialist and Cleverley and Welbeck, because they were out on loan to other clubs, Ashley Young, he looked the most certain starter of them all. They'd got De Gea in. Again, it was a bit of a trialist with such a young keeper. And the final one was Phil Jones. Again, no real guarantees. And I think United have to go and get three or four big players to come in and say they're going to be in my first 11. I'm not convinced about United's fullbacks either. I think that's been a problem for them since Gary Neville. Patrice Evra, I think he's fantastic going forward, but I'm not a great fan of his defending as a left back. And like you said, midfield needs shoring up. I do think they've got a lot of good forwards. So there is room for United, but they've got to be competitive and competing against the top sides.
Ollie, we're going to get to relegation in a second. I just want to get you quickly on the Manchester City manager. One school of thought is that, it's easy to win when you spend bazillions and bazillions. And that it would apply to Roberto Mancini just as much as I'd imagine it would apply to Jose Mourinho's record-breaking season at Real Madrid. But then there's another school of thought that says when you spend a lot of money, you bring in a lot of egos, you raise a lot of expectations, going that extra mile, that extra stop from second to first place is actually exceptionally difficult. Which is it? Because last week we had our boss, Tony Evans, here, and he basically suggested that, you could have put any old schmo in Mancini's place and they probably would have been competing for the title.
I disagree with Tony on that. He has done what he was brought there to do. He has turned them into a team who, for all but about 4 weeks of this season, have played with a fantastic attitude and a fantastic mentality. So I think he deserves great credit.
And enough happy talk, and on to something less pleasant, which is Bolton Wanderers relegation. Now, it's always cruel when a team goes down. In this case, I don't want to go on about referees again, but you kind of have to, I think. Allison, you're the qualified ref. I don't believe it's 1930. I don't believe people are playing with medicine balls and Nat Lofthouse is the big striker stomping on a goalkeeper's head. So how do you explain this Jonathan Walters, Adam Bogdan thing?
Well, it's not 2008, never mind 1930, because usually over the past sort of decade, what you found is that keepers have been overprotected by referees, almost to a laughable degree sometimes. You know, anything happens, it looks like maybe the keeper might have been, you know, slightly touched. Oh, well, we have to blow the whistle. And this, I think, was unfortunately for Bolton, brought it back into line with how the game really ought to be played, because the referee has to decide, is the keeper in full control of the ball or not? And I think it was really marginal, and I think probably I would have said it was a free kick and it shouldn't have been a goal, but it was marginal enough not to be a ghastly mistake. It's just I think we've become so used to thinking that any time a goalkeeper is touched, it should be a free kick, and that is not true. And it's a bit of a fallacy. If he's got two hands on the ball, it's automatically his in his possession. That's not true. He wasn't quite in control, but it was controversial enough to be, and I think it's been overlooked because of what a great, amazing day of football it was. If that had been the only game of the day, everyone would be absolutely gobsmacked that the goal was allowed. I agree.
Cass, I'm looking at you since I'm assuming you came with close proximity with goalkeepers.
Yeah. I'm not a qualified referee like Alisson.
No, but we all know what, I mean, Alisson kind of explained what the rule is, right? So, yeah. And we there's no point in saying what the rule should be. But did it look to you like that was a foul? Or Stephen, just with your own eyes?
I'm absolutely with Alisson, because the modern game has been littered with the slightest of touches and the slightest. We're looking at every angle, at every position on a pitch, and if a goalkeeper does get challenged in that particular manner, everyone's up in arms. I didn't think it was that bad, but
it's a foul.
Well, as we see football today, yes.
Okay, but this is today. And if you are going to change it, you don't change it all of a sudden in the last game of the season to send Bolton down. I mean, am I wrong here, Ollie?
No, I thought it was a bizarre decision. You never expect the striker to get the benefit of the doubt in those situations. You always expect the goalkeeper to get the benefit of the doubt. And I don't even think there should have been any doubt. I thought Bogdan had the ball and Walters sort of came in contact with him rather than with the ball, and it, you know, it flew up and went in. I feel desperately sorry for Bolton to go down in those circumstances. I know it all tends to even out, and people will think about the goal that shouldn't have been against, the QPR goal that wasn't given against Bolton. But yeah. I thought that was a terrible way to go to be relegated.
Well, I thought the penalty decision for Stoke was pretty dramatic as well, don't you?
So does this mean then that Chris Ford, the British cyclist, is going to get all this abuse now on Twitter from Bolton fans?
Gad. It's part of the game. The game had four goals, and one of the goals was for Bolton was where the keeper, Sorensen's, threw it back to the net. And the two goals for Stoke were, okay, Walters was involved in taking the penalty, but I thought the penalty was a pretty poor decision. As much as the first goal, I thought the penalty was...
Well, I don't want to... I promised myself that, it's the end of the season, let's go off in the summer. Let's not go and slaughter referees. I think referees have been a joke this season, frankly. I think it's been a pretty bad season all around. I think there have been some exceptions. But I think that basically they've changed the outcome of the Premier League. So I don't want to say it because then I'm being negative and I'm raining everybody's parade. And today this was the most fantastic season in the history of the Premier League, as that poll showed. And we're all happy. And
cloud cuckoo lands. You. There will never be a season where every referee performance will be
no. Nobody's perfect. Asking for that. Nobody's asking for that. But I think there are certain teams that, it's the luck of the draw, perhaps, had more decisions go against them this season and were thus more penalized. And there were also some mistakes this season that I don't think simply are acceptable. And I think the Premier League would be better off if, instead of employing who they think are the 20 best English referees in the world, if, just as they do with their footballers and their managers, they went out and said, hey, let's work away so that we can sign the 20 best referees in the world. Right? I think you'd be better off. I don't see why there's freedom of movement for players and coaches and owners and whatever, but this is the one category where you're stuck with these same 20 people who happen to be not even British. They have to be English, basically, right?
I still don't think it would make much difference. I still
no, because
we'd
referees
sit
are all
the
same. We never discuss them.
Saying, "Oh my goodness, did you see what the referee did?"
No, but I'm not allowed to say that this season I thought there were more mistakes or more incidents than last season. The referees have to be consistent all the time. They can't have a good year and a bad year.
Bill Edgar, would he know?
I'm sure Bill Edgar would know. But enough. Let's go from referees to happy thoughts. Champions League final this Saturday. Bayern Munich and Chelsea. I kind of feel that we're all sort of spent from this incredible final day of the season. So I'm sure the preview will build up and excitement will build. But
I'd actually just forgotten about that.
There you go, Cass. You're a former Chelsea player. I'm sure you hadn't forgotten about it. Two teams that. Kind of Chelsea difficult to judge because the last couple of weeks they've had up and down results except for the FA Cup of course, but they've basically been preparing for this game. Bayern Munich on the other hand coming off a 5-2 hammering in the German Cup final where their defense looked absolutely terrible. The good news is that defense they had out there, those were actually the starters, many of whom are suspended, so you're not even going to get them in Munich. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are, planning their own backyard is a huge obstacle for Chelsea to overcome. They're going to have to play really well. I'm so disappointed with really the rules of football that don't allow clubs to play their strongest sides. I mean, one thing I would say about Bayern, and you know, Dortmund did beat them, and they beat them really comfortable, was the lineup was really strong by Bayern. I was actually surprised.
Bayern's best 11.
Yeah, best 11, which really surprised me. I think handling of the front three is going to be an issue for Chelsea. You know, looking at Gomez, you know, his heading ability, also his movement, his strength, and technically he's very good as well. And then he's got the likes of Iron Robin and Ribery. I think that's something for Ashley Cole's got to be absolutely top of his game. Because of the way football is, and we've seen this weekend, the unexpected, I think Chelsea have got a real mountain to climb, and in some ways I do think it'll be harder than their Barcelona result. I'm looking forward to it, in the fact to see Ribéry's put all his, you know, which he's wanted to do, he's gone for everything by changing the Chelsea team in the last few Premier League games, hasn't he? You know, he's really set his sights on the 11 that's going to go out there are going to be as fresh as they can be. They're going to have to put a lot of work in, and I think he'll go with his tactics of trying to stop Bayern and know that he'll get chances against a back four that is certainly weaker than Barca's for me. Whether you disagree or agree, Gab, that's how I see it. I think Bayern can be, you can get at them, but I think the biggest problem is trying to stop them because they are a very, very good front three.
There's no question that the back four that Bayern are going to play are weaker than Barcelona's.
Will Van Buiten be back in the team? Because
Van Buiten played 59 minutes on Friday for the C team. But you know,
I want him to be fit.
He's been out since January.
Yeah,
whether it's Van Boyne or Timoshuk, if you're a Bayern fan, you know, you're going to be pretty jittery. Allison, if you're Di Matteo, do you turn around, maybe turn to positive? If they are going to be a defensively weak team, Di Matteo is fundamentally an attack-minded manager who didn't play that way because he had to. He felt he had to since becoming the number one at Chelsea. But previous to that, his record is there for all to see. Given the problems in Bayern's defense, do you just say, hey, you know what, my defensive guys are out? Hey, no problem. I'll chuck a little bit of Mata, Drogba, Kalou at you, maybe a splash of Malouda, and have my fullbacks attack you, and we'll go at it. You know, we'll have a slugfest.
That's the big call for Di Matteo. Does he think, I'm going to play two holding players in front of my weakened defence, which he has done to some some success since he came in.
Although when one of the two is Frank Lampard, when he's played Lampard and Mikel, like against Napoli in that 4-2-3-1, you know, you're still playing a more offensively minded player in a deeper position.
Well, that's the big call, isn't it? Yeah, it's how you set that up. Do you play two fairly conservative players in front of the back four, or do you have your shape defensively but play someone like Lampard who's attack-minded, or, as you say, Gab, do you just go for it? That's going to be his big shout, and he'll get the job or not get the job at Chelsea based on how he organises the team. I would add, all season I've been saying, oh, the Champions League looked like it could well be Bayern's after all. It's in the Allianz Arena. What you know, it's sort of fate and how marvellous if you do get there and it's your hope. Actually, I think it might be a disadvantage to Bayern because the stadium will be nothing like they expect it to be. I think it might undermine them just slightly. They go there and it's not a home match. There are going to be slightly more Germans there, but not that many more. I think they could find it slightly unnerving to have their own home stadium sort of decked out in the Champions League livery. And Chelsea, I think, will go in with that, deliberately plug the underdog tag and could just nick it on that basis.
Time for some quick hits. Tottenham finished fourth, and it could mean Champions League football if Chelsea don't beat Bayern next Saturday. Cass, what's more important, hanging on to Adebayor or adding depth to the centre of the Tottenham defence?
I think the depth of the defence, I think with Ledley and Gallas, it's been a problem, especially in the second part of the season. They were conceding way too many goals. And I think Harry will certainly look, I mean, having Ledley miss so much of training and only be available for games and not that many games is a problem. Adebayor, I think it's a tough call on him because if he's the Adebayor with a bit between his teeth, I think he can be a great player. The trouble is I never know how long it's going to last with him.
So I take it from your answer that adding depth to the defence is far more important than keeping Adebayor.
That's what I said at the very start.
Thank you. Everton finish above Liverpool in the table. Alison, the Times gave Liverpool's season a C-plus grade, which I thought was actually somewhat generous. And we noted, and no, by the way, that wasn't Tony Evans filling it out, nor was it Tony Barrett. And in that same report card, we noted that Liverpool need a new stadium, a new chief executive, a new director of football, and a new director of communication, plus they need to fix the team itself, which may take some time. Brutal question for you. Do they need a new manager, too?
A couple of days ago, the answer was no. And I think most people in and outside Liverpool would have said, look, you know, give Kenny another season to get it right. But as soon as people like Roberto Martinez are linked to the club, I think people think, oh, actually, what Liverpool could do with a young manager, someone who's still passionate, young, energetic, sticks to his principles, obviously on the upward trajectory. And you compare that to Kenny, who's been out the game a long time and I think has struggled because he's been not completely out of the game, but he's not been at the cutting edge of the game. And I think he's struggled with that at times. So deep intake of breath. I think maybe Liverpool do need a new manager.
All right, I'm going to stop you there before the Tonys come and get you and beat you savagely for what you just said, and let's move on and pretend that never happened. Wolves are going down. They were beaten again by Wigan, but they've done something about it, appointing Ståle Solbakken, he of the four league titles with Copenhagen, and near fisticuffs with Pep Guardiola. Ollie, as you know, I'm a pretentious Euro snob, so of course, I love the appointment. You're more grounded in harsh northern reality. Is this really a better decision than, say, the old familiar faces of Alan Kerbishley or Steve Bruce?
The idea of an Alan Kerbishley type appointment would have left me cold, really. I think Solbakken is, at least it's a bit more adventurous, it's a bit, you know, more fresh and will probably energise the club in some ways, or at least that's how it's thought out. I mean, I would love to know the thought process and whether it was meticulously researched and so on, because their previous decision, which was to sack McCarthy and not hire a replacement, that looked particularly ill-researched. So you've got to be slightly sceptical about it, but I think it's an interesting appointment, a gamble certainly, but I prefer a gamble to one of those tired old faces.
Gab, here's one for you. There's one game to go in France, and Carlo Ancelotti's Paris Saint-Germain were trying to close the gap on Montpellier. Did they succeed?
No, Alison, they didn't. And again, it was very dramatic. Not as dramatic as the biggest and best league in the world, of course, but they do have one match to play. But Paris Saint-Germain were three games behind. They were playing Rennes at home. They pummeled them. They won 3-0. In the meantime, Montpellier, they were at home to Lille. And The game went right down into injury time, and it was still 0-0, which meant that Paris Saint-Germain had closed the gap to just a single point. Remember, PSG had the edge in terms of goal difference. And then deep, deep, deep into injury time, Olivier Giroud sets up the winning goal for Montpellier, and they win. And now it's, you know, they'd have to lose on the final day of the season, coupled with a Paris Saint-Germain victory. I don't think it's going to happen. And so it's a tremendous story, this tiny, tiny club.
Close to Marseille again.
Well, there you go. That makes you instantly like him. René Girard, Olivier Giroud, Younes Bahanda. These are all names that I think you'll be hearing more of. That's all we've got time for this week. But before I let you go, a quick reminder that we're doing another live roadshow with me and some very special guests. Skinner, I think I can say who they are. It's Sir Bobby Charlton. It's Super Agent Mark Curtis. It's Diego Armando Maradona. I know you're excited. It's Joey Barton and it's Mario Balotelli. They'll all be joining me at the Freemasons Arm near Covent Garden in London. And that's on May 29th from 7 p.m. Scheduled appearances, of course, subject to change at the last minute. In fact, right now, because none of those people are coming, it'll probably just be me and a bunch of people from the Times podcast. But you can still book at www.timestickets.co.uk or call 0871-620-4025. All of this yours for just £7.50 per person. Until then, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. You can follow us on Twitter. There's an exciting segment coming up where all of us have put out our teams of our 11s of the seasons. I'm rather embarrassed to say this, but mine is almost identical to Ollie K's. I don't know what that says. I thought I was being very different by putting a couple Newcastle players in there, but I guess maybe I wasn't. Till next time, bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.